What else did you learn from your dad that you think is very useful?
He said that it's always better to be one time red than a thousand times pale. So what that means is it's better to say the things you don't want to say once.
Okay.
Just maybe like get out of it, or just like be frustrated a thousand days, you know?
Very interesting.
And that's very true.
Web2 gaming, how much money they actually make with these in-game purchases?
Huge. It's almost a $200 billion market this year. And everybody says this cliche thing, but it's true. Like, it's bigger than movies and music combined. Like, it's the biggest form of entertainment by far, you know? We started GG's because we saw an opportunity to help Latin American gamers make a living off of gaming, which is like every gamer's dream, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you play and you play a lot and it's your passion, like, imagine if you could make money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really possible to do until Web3. If you are concerned to be bothered by being a parent, you shouldn't be a parent. And same thing with relationships, right? Like, I feel like from our generation down, everybody wants it easy, but wants the whole thing. They want the whole cake without the effort. So what does that mean? It means I want this amazing person to be my partner. I want this amazing, like, dream relationship, but I'm not willing to work for it. I'm not willing to go through frustration. I'm not willing to go through conflict. I'm not willing to work on myself. I'm not willing to see what I'm doing wrong. Like, right now, I'm like the typical gamer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. And focused on the health and fitness,
yeah.
Counting macros.
Yeah, exactly.
So you want to be the dude who looks really good and who does all, basically turn your passion into a job. And leverage the internet to scale, basically.
Yeah, ideally.
For leverage. So macro counting, yeah?
Yeah.
Why did you start that?
I wanted to be healthier and fitter. Like, I want to be ripped, you know, like I want to look good. I want to feel good.
Why do you want to be ripped? You said I want to look good and I want to feel good.
Yeah.
Is it the same thing or not?
Yeah. So for me, I remember, like, I have this friend, he's a CEO as well. And he always says that wealth starts with fitness. And when you look at the mirror and you see yourself looking good, your mind also starts to feel good. And you start thinking like, okay, if I can make my body look good, what else can I do better? Right?
Absolutely.
And for me, that's like the main thing. You know, it sets my mind to be better at something. That's why I also take ice baths like every day.
So it not only sets your mind to feel better, but actually it sets the expectation on the other side when you meet people, especially in business.
That's true.
Like, you're just showing, people realize, oh man, this person is fit. Like, you basically set a certain level of respect that you would just not have if you were just like not fit or actually even fat.
Yes.
Right? You're like, oh man, this person takes care of themselves in addition to building a company or having this interesting career. So
it's a set of things, right? Like, it's being fit. It's learning how to dress. I'm not saying like you should dress, you know, old fashioned and whatever, like dress how you like, but dress well, like be well presented. I think that's important.
Mm.
Good posture is important. Having a good tone of voice is important. Like, those things in business do command respect. And it does make a difference, especially as a CEO, when you're pitching, say, investors, or when you're pitching clients, that does make a difference.
Did you study the posture thing or?
No. I just had a very strict dad.
Okay. So he told you?
Yeah, like,
stand straight.
Stand up like a man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. What else did you learn from your dad that you think is very useful?
Quite a bit. I don't know if the saying, it's in Spanish because I'm Colombian, but he said that it's always better to be one time red than a thousand times pale. So what that means is it's better to say the things you don't want to say once.
Okay.
Just maybe like get out of it, or just like be frustrated a thousand days, you know?
Very interesting.
And that's very true.
So that's very important in business. A lot of founders, we have Luca Netz from Pudgy Penguins later on today. And he talks about that. He says one of his biggest mistakes is not making the key decisions earlier. For example, I know I need to fire someone. I'm going to try to find excuses and undo it.
Yeah.
And like, that's the classic being a big, basically being a people pleaser. I'm a people pleaser. And that's very problematic in business because you don't want to be too mean. And you're like, oh man, maybe this person is going to get better. But like, as you say, if you're read once, but you say, okay, I'm sorry, it's not going to work out. Instead of like just being there and building up this frustration.
And it's such a, it's a balance of things, right? Because on one end, like, in my personal life, I am a people pleaser.
Okay.
But I've learned how to do it in a healthy way. Like not disregarding myself, like not doing it for the wrong reasons, like not doing it to fill in voids in myself. And in business, I went to the opposite side. Like I went like full, almost dictator mode, right? And none of them are good.
How do you even do that? How can you be different in business than in real life? For me, I found like it's all one. And obviously, you get fucked a few times in business. Like, you learn to be less nice, but you still, I think your true nature is still in there. So how do you become a dictator in business when you're a people pleaser in life?
More than being a dictator, I think it's learning to rely on objective things like data in purchases and revenue and follow that. And also qualitative feedback from like your clients and mainly your clients. So I was going to say investors, but you shouldn't always listen to your investors. And so it's measuring objective things. And then when you're sure of something, like let's say you're growing revenue, right? You have a good product. People are saying, I love it. But your team for some reason wants to launch this and that, and they want to focus on this and that, and they want to do. It's your job as a CEO to say, fuck no. Like, that's not going to happen. This is the way, and that's it. You don't like it, get a job elsewhere, right? Mm. So that's the way that you, it's a dictatorship in that regard, but it's aligned with the vision and the purpose of your business, and it's tied to objective metrics, not just because I want to say them that this is the way that we're going to do it. It's because there's something to back it up, right?
Okay, you do that during the day, but then you go home.
Yeah.
Can you sleep at night or not? Because for me, I would be like, oh man, I remember having to fire some people who were actually not even bad. It's because we would lose clients and we didn't need these people anymore. Otherwise, the business would not do properly, you know? And I would remember spending entire nights without sleeping, you know? So like the disconnection between the business and my own personality. And like, yes, you can have all these, you need to follow the metrics. You need to follow the data. That's for sure. And you also need to follow your intuition because people often don't understand it until it shapes into like truth, actual truth, because you have your vision, obviously. And you need to be, I think it's really good as an entrepreneur to be, you're very stubborn. Like you need to get the feedback, but if you have your idea, like, and your vision, like you need to stick to it. And
it's a very hard balance because there's moments when you need to trust your gut and there's moments when you just need to stick to the metrics and you need to find when are those key decisions and there's no right answer to that. Like it's a mix of experience and screwing it up a couple times and just learning.
Do you have co-founders?
So I was a solo founder.
Okay.
And I brought in two co-founders later. When we raised our first round.
Why did you do that?
Because they're really good. Like they make the company better. So, and I've been working with them 6 years. With one of them six, with the other one, we're almost best friends since we were like five. And we worked like 6 years ago as well.
Together.
Yeah, together.
We worked together.
Yeah.
That's a risky one, actually. Building business with friends.
Yeah.
It's... you can often lose your friendship.
Yeah. So I think the difference here is that we've been working together quite a bit. We've gone through a lot in business and working together over the past few years. So it's funny because there's like four of my friends work for my company, but they don't work because they're friends. They work because we worked previously.
They're good.
Just because organically it was like, hey, I got this thing. I got this project. They're all gamers as well. So it got into that.
How do you manage negative feedback towards them when they're your friends?
So
they're so good. You don't have any negative feedback.
No, I have plenty. I'm very strict and I'm very demanding.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a good thing and sometimes it's not. I'm still learning how to balance that as well. In general, in my life, it's hard when you're doing a startup and when you're trying to do a top startup, like a top 1% startup, right? Like before the podcast, we were talking with one of my investors, right, with Eddie, and he was saying, like, you asked him, like, how many times do you say yes to a deal? And he said, like, very few, right?
Putting some pressure on you. And, additional pressure on you.
And maybe, but more than that, yeah.
I mean, it also gives you motivation. Gives I'm the one who was selected.
It gives you merit as well.
Yeah.
But it also gives you, it sets you on a standard that you know you need to live up to.
Yeah.
Right? So, for example,
it almost disappoints.
Another of our funds is called Boost.
Mm.
They literally invest in 1% of the businesses they talk to.
Okay.
So out of 1,000, they invest in 10. And we were like the 10th company on the, they call it tribe. So it was like the cohort that we were in. And that was last year. And we were, so it was Coincilium. It was Boost. Then one of the biggest exchanges as well in Latin America invested in us. So, and we're like, I think the right now, the only startup that's doing what we do in my region in Latin America. So then when you have all those expectations, yeah, like you feel some pressure, but you also feel the need. And at least in my case, I don't feel so pressured by my investors because honest to God, I love them. I have the best investors. They're aligned with what I want to do. Like they're like, if that's your vision, go for it. If you screw it up, we don't care. You know, of course, if we do screw it up, they're going
to
care.
Obviously. Okay, that's very interesting because I was about to ask, how do you deal with investors and where they all have their... They mainly want a return, obviously, but they all also have their own kind of vision or ideas. But like, if you're with people, we just say, we trust you.
So it's finding the right investors. I think in everything in life and relationships, what I learned is it's about finding the right people who you can speak the same language, right? And get to middle grounds. With my investors, I don't need to explain them. I don't need to, I have founder friends that they raise money and they have nightmares with their investors. Like they don't sleep at night. They get calls at midnight because their investors are literally pressuring them to hire more people, fire people, move business models around. I don't do that. If one of my investors did that, I'll give you back your money. You know, I don't do that. If you're aligned.
I can see the father character here.
Yeah. But it's because there's a vision, there's a purpose. And I'm going to stick to that, right? And if you invest in me, you need to invest in the purpose and in me as a founder. And if you invested in that, then you need to let me do my job and I'll take care of it and I'll make this a success.
So what's the vision and the purpose?
Well, in GGs, we want to have...
What does GG stand for?
So GGs is like the main term in gaming. Whenever you finish a match, you say, hey, GG, bro.
Ah, okay.
So it's a good game.
I see, good game. Yeah, well done.
So okay. If you played the whole night, let's say you and I played the whole night, it's like GGs.
Okay.
You know? So it's like we coined that term in Latin America. Everybody in that's a gamer, like understands it immediately. And we started GGs because we saw an opportunity to help Latin American gamers make a living off gaming, which is like every gamer's dream, right?
Yeah.
Like if you play and you play a lot and it's your passion, like imagine if you could make money out of it. And now imagine if you're a gamer in, I don't know, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Mexico, like these countries, and you can make sort of a living by playing. It's insane. It's like for us, it was like a utopian scenario, right?
Mm.
And it wasn't really possible to do until Web3. And then with Play to Earn, it was sort of possible, but unsustainable.
So subsidized by
a Ponzi-nomic model. Yeah, like horrible. And we knew that. And we were actually, when we were raising pre-seed, we were one of the few companies that said that out loud. Like I remember when we pitched our investors, we were like, this is going to blow up. Like, this is not the thing.
Cannot work.
And we know it because we come from LATAM. There's hyperinflation. There's screwed up currencies all over. Like, we understand when
this is just another currency that's being printed out of thin air to give to people and it's not going to be valuable.
Yeah. With the added unsustainability of you needed to buy an NFT to get into the game. So it was literally a Ponzi-nomic.
Yeah.
So no, that doesn't work. Of course not. But ownership is really cool. Trading skins, it's something that's been proven in gaming time and time again. CSGO is a great example of that. CSGO moves more volume today, trading volume, than the blue chip NFTs combined. And it's Web 2. Like, they don't even own those skins, you know? And it's moving more volume than that. Illegally, there's plenty of black market sites where you can buy in-game currencies, when you can get people to get into your character in a game and grind it out and make gold, for example, in World of Warcraft. That was a thing for years. In different MMOs, you could level up your character. You can then sell it on, like, again, it was very insecure because there's no Web3, there's no ownership. So you would need to say, I want to sell you my character. I would need to give you access to my password and you would need to send me money for it.
Yeah.
So if I gave you access and you didn't send me money, like, I lost my account. So Web3 does solve those things. But people got it confused. They thought, like, okay, play to earn. Let's all be rich. Let's put, like, you know, 2,000 Filipinos and 10,000 Argentinians and let's get them to work. And that's it. That's the motto. Of course, that doesn't work. That's not it.
So what's the motto?
Ownership in trading. I think that's skill-based earning. So I'll give you an example. I spent, like, I don't know, $500 or so on Warzone 1, on Call of Duty. I love Call of Duty.
Yeah.
And I'm good at it. And so I bought, like, a premium character skin, like an operator skin. I had, like, this amazing set of weapons. I had, like, a Rolex as well in that. And they closed Warzone 1, I think, last week or this week. Like, they're closing it, like, forever. I lost it.
What does that mean?
That means the game's shutting down. The game's not working anymore. So now there's Warzone 2, but I couldn't bring...
Why did they do that?
Because Warzone 1 is an old IP. Yeah. So they're focusing on the new one. And they want to make, of course, more money from the same people. So it's Web 2 gaming.
So they're basically screwing their first loyal customers and saying, if you don't upgrade...
So one way of looking at it...
There's no bridge between this first version and the second version.
No. There's going to be a bridge from the new ones. And a lot of Web 2 publishers are doing that now.
That's very interesting.
Which is cool. But it's not Web 3, right? It's like only within my titles.
Yeah.
Which is good. I think it's a very good step. CSGO did that. Warzone has sort of been announcing it, like saying it.
So you build this character and all these sort of assets, digital assets, but you lost them.
Yeah.
And you have no control over that.
Yeah. And I would like to at least be able to resell them, trade them. If, say, I bought my character and I'm not using it anymore, I would like to have those options. And I think Web3 does solve that. And that's, people don't understand that that's
how valuable
business.
Is what you built. To give an idea, or like how valuable is something that someone could build, like the best guys out there who also lost everything because they couldn't move to this second version.
So it depends, right? If it's a skin of someone like me, that's nobody, like maybe nothing, maybe the price I paid for, maybe the price I paid for on a discount, I don't know. Or maybe I can trade it for a similar skin, which is nice. Like I get what I want anyway. But let's say I'm a very, let's say I bought this skin and I became like a very famous content creator. Now all of a sudden that's the skin of whoever, right? Like a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
So now that skin can be worth like tens of thousands of dollars, right? Now it's a legendary, very rare skin that I used. So I think it works very similar to brands like Jordan's, to brands like Rolex. It has that same component if you look at it that way.
Okay. Okay, so you're trying to solve this problem of people being able to keep the sort of digital assets they've built and move on not only to next versions, but also go across games. So what's the goal?
The ultimate goal is to help gamers in Latin America make a living through video games. That's important because it's very hard to make a living in Latin America, and it's the hardest it's ever been.
Can you give some examples of like how much people earn in Colombia? What's the average or median salary and what's possible with gaming to give an idea? For example, if we talk about, we had a co-founder of YGG, Yield Game, on the podcast. And there was the Axie Infinity kind of craze where people were like, oh man, I can earn more money just playing games than doing anything in my normal job. You know, like, do you have some example of what people earn by doing, I don't know, an office job or whatever. And then what's possible in gaming? Obviously, let's not look at the top 1%, you know, streamers,
yeah,
or like,
yeah,
because this is obviously, like, we know about that, but like, yeah, more how can most people actually understand, oh, this is an opportunity for me, and also even for investors who invest in your company, saying, yeah, oh, you're actually going to the long tail,
yeah,
you know, the mass market,
yeah. So there's no easy answer, simple answer to that, for a couple of reasons. Player earn is dead. Like, Web3 gaming right now is dead. And most good Web3 games are launching next year. So there's nothing right now. Like, if you try to make money and get, like, there's no good games right now. And the main lesson from Axie and from PegAxie and all these Web3 games was that you need to first build a really good game, and then you can build an economy on top of that. Not do it backwards, right? Like, not start with the economy. And it needs to be sustainable. And it, like, there's a whole thing. Onboarding alone in Web3 is, like, super hard right now. So it hasn't even solved that yet, Web3, right? Like, there's no solution to onboard mass users yet, like a Google login or something of that nature. So it's not built yet. So that's one part. The other part is that there are ways to earn in Web2, but they're also limited, as you said. Like, there's esports, there's streaming, but those are, you make good money if you're actually like top 1%, top 3% within those pools. But we're not gearing up. So there's two things that we're doing. We said, like, okay, we can't solve make a living for gamers right now. So then what's the next best thing, right? So what we're doing right now is we're giving them more value for what they pay. So what we do is we have like a premium subscription where they pay $6.99 and they get up to $70 in value. So we make at least their gaming experience like a lot more valuable right now. And that's step one. Step two is when you pay the subscription, you start getting skins, items, currency, and your favorite games. Web2 games. These are not NFTs. These are not tokens. None of that. And so we found, like, this is very recent that we've been iterating with this. And we found that sometimes gamers get a skin that they don't like, or gamers get a thing that they're not going to use. And so now we're enabling them to trade that for something else with someone else. And it's Web2. It's not an NFT. So it's very manually. It's horrible. It's not the ideal. But here's the opportunity that I see. Next year, when all these games launch, the good Web3 games, and they do have those components, and you can become good at those games, you can start minting and trading, and it's all secure and it's all out better, we can have that infrastructure ready, and we can tell gamers, like, hey, you join GGs, and we help you build your gaming portfolio. And that, I think, is very sustainable, because it's already been happening for years with CSGO. Like, that's proven. It's a proven model. It just needs to, it needs better security. It needs interoperability. It needs more openness and safety for users. But that's a thing you can do to make money. And if you're also good at a game, but let's say you're not esports level, but you're good, right? Like, you can go in rank mode and you can rank up quite a bit. Games, Web3 games have, and for example, Dota 2 has a similar thing, where part of the revenue that the game receives, it gives back to the users in the shape of prize pools. In this type of stuff, I think that's a brilliant model. And if you're maybe not top 1%, but you're top 10% in a game, you can still make tokens out of it, and that's great.
How big? Do you have some numbers on Web2 gaming? How much money they actually make with these sort of in-game purchases? How big is this? Also compared to like their revenue, is it like a majority of their revenue? Because people who have no idea about gaming and even no idea that there is a massive market with this gaming and esports and everything, basically.
Yeah, it's huge. It's almost a $200 billion market this year, which is, and everybody says this cliche thing, but it's true. Like, it's bigger than movies and music combined. Like, it's the biggest form of entertainment by far, you know? There's 3 billion gamers in the planet, This includes, of course, casual gamers. This includes people that play Candy Crush, or like, includes everything.
Okay.
Right? If you play solitaire in your phone, that's in that.
You're a gamer. Okay.
Mid-core gamers, it's a little bit smaller, but it's still like huge. And about 70% of that market, like of the 200 billion, is owned by the AAA publishers. And most AAA publishers are owned or invested by Tencent. So gaming is a huge thing. That's also very like...
What's a AAA producer?
So like Blizzard, Activision, those type, Supercell.
What's the problem if it's a monopoly?
So one example of a problem that EA is a very famous company for not being that kind to gamers. So it was with the Star Wars game years ago, they had control of that IP, right? Mm. And so what they did is they launched like loot boxes. And since they kind of knew that they could do whatever they wanted with it, then they just overpriced it. You needed to pay like, I think it was like $1,000 for like unlocking the characters that you actually wanted. Like it was abuse. Mm. But gamers started complaining about that. The stock went down, they had to change it. Like, it's good. Like, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But those are the risks of a monopoly.
What would you tell parents whose kids are spending, according to them, way too much time playing video games? Because I'll just say something regarding that. I'm not a gamer. I played one or two games when I was I would play a PlayStation, like more sports game, and I would realize I had like a volatile character, like smash a few remotes and everything.
It happens.
And also, I have a very addictive personality, mm-hmm. which is why crypto. And like, I got hooked to one of these games, actually. It was a 24/7 online game where you go, it was called O Game, Conquer Planets. But the whole thing is happening even while you're at school, you know, so you can get attacked while you're at school, but you're not there. So I had to, every morning before going to school or every lunch and every evening, I had to go like run home, check if I was attacked, etc. And I was like, oh man, this is not sustainable for me. But what I realized, for example, in crypto, a lot of like the really good traders or the people who did really great in crypto or even in entrepreneurship in general are previous gamers. And the reason why gaming really helped them is because of strategy. You know, understanding strategy and how to manage scarce resources at a young age, which is really interesting when you put this into perspective with parents who, you know, you have all these phones, all these things, like, I don't know how to control that. My child is hooked and like he's spending too much time playing these weird games and this is really bad. And so what would you tell them?
So again, I think that's it's a complicated thing. On one regard, it is true that especially online games do build critical thinking, and especially it builds the ability to make decisions under pressure.
Can you give some examples?
Call of Duty Warzone, in any shooter game. I'll give you an example. Yeah. Like whenever I used to play in Warzone 1, something called solo quads, which is you play alone, but you're playing against squad of fours people. So every battle that you go in, you're at disadvantage because you're alone and there are four, right? And there's insane amount of variables. Like they can be camping in a building. You need to figure your way out. Like you need to shoot them through the window. You need to throw a smoke grenade. You need to throw a stun. Like there's so many options and you need to think like this. And once you see an opening, you have literally like a second or a little bit less than a second to make a decision and decide to take cover or not take cover, decide to take cover or push, decide to go into that door or take the window off. You know, it's a limitless amount of decision making within a minute. And that does build character for entrepreneurship. That is literally entrepreneurship. It's making decisions all the time, plenty of them, under pressure. And you wish that you can make them a little bit slower. You wish like your business could wait for you just a little bit, but it won't. And so you need to do them now. You need to do them well. So it helps with that. Now, there's also issues, health issues, especially with kids. Overall, I don't think a kid should be watching. It's proven, like, you shouldn't watch as a kid small screens in general, because your eyes are not built for it. So your eyes form badly.
What's a kid?
So literally like 3 years old plus, right?
So what age can you start? What can you start watching too much
from 12
screen time? From 12 onwards, okay.
Like
even sounds early. Like I think even your brain is not fully developed, I think, until even like 21 or 23. Exactly. So
23, 25, yeah. So I have two little half brothers, which they're my brothers. I don't call them half brothers, but they're from a separate marriage of my dad. And they have like 5 and 3 right now, or 7 and 3.
How old are you?
30.
30, okay.
And literally the doctor just prohibited like screens for them because they're starting to get like their eyes screwed up.
Right? Okay.
So they can't watch like on a phone. They can only use like the big screen and everything.
How did your family realize they have problems in the eyes?
They just went to a consultation with doctor and they just said like, stop it. You know, you can't do that. But beyond the screen thing, there's the dopamine thing, which is even worse.
Absolutely.
Especially with games built for kids. Those games tend to be like designed to a granular level to give you as many dopamine hits as
you can. So it's the same as social media, basically. How do I hook you up as much as possible?
And that's very dangerous because dopamine, I think you know this, like dopamine has highs, but then it's very, very difficult the second and the third and the 15th and the 50th time to get to that same high. You need more dopamine hits to get to that same level. So you need to be using your phone a lot more to get the same level of arousal, excitement. That's horrible. It makes you more addicted. And then the thing is, dopamine has a base level. And with most addictions, you get to the peak, but then you drop below your base level. And that makes you depressed and anxious. So basically, phones literally are designed to make you anxious and depressed.
And so are those games.
Yeah, especially casual games.
So what's the solution to that?
That's a tough question. That's a money-making question if you resolve that. But for now, I'd say if you're a parent, don't let your kids play that much. Like it shouldn't be, a kid should be outside. Like I'm a gamer, I play a lot. And I think my parents, that they only let me play for 2 hours a day. And that was it.
That was another generation. Because now you're saying go outside. For us, I'm 31. I used to go outside a lot. You know, we didn't have all these phones. And we're the old generation, man. Like, what are you going to do with your kids? Because the problem is, you set the rules. But like, if most parents are lazy and as soon as there is an issue with their kids is, play this game. Watch this. Leave me alone. And even in the restaurant, you go to the restaurant in this city, man.
Yeah.
Every kid has a 3 years old kid, but just because a parent doesn't want to be bothered.
Yeah.
The problem is you can be an outlier parent and like want the best for your kid. But if your kids, then they start to go to school and they see everyone else with a screen, you know, like they will come and say, hey.
Yeah. But then
I want my Candy Crush too.
Yeah. I mean, and you can have it, but maybe just an hour a day, right? Like, and you need to set rules for that. Like for me, if you are concerned to be bothered by being a parent, you shouldn't be a parent. And same thing with relationships, right? Like I feel like from our generation down, everybody wants it easy, but wants the whole thing. They want the whole cake without the effort. So what does that mean? It means I want this amazing person to be my partner. I want this amazing like dream relationship, but I'm not willing to work for it. I'm not willing to go through frustration. I'm not willing to go through conflict. I'm not willing to work on myself. I'm not willing to see what I'm doing wrong. Like everybody's just
criticizing the other one. I have two completely different questions. I'll go with the first one, which is linked to addictions and dopamine. Your phone is on the table. What's your relationship with your phone? Very honestly.
Yeah. When I'm traveling, I'm a little bit more, how do you say it, on it, for two reasons. One, I want to make the most out of these events. So I'm scheduling meetings. I'm replying with my team. I only have normally till noon of this time zone to be able to talk with my team. So normally the first part of the day, I need to be like super on it. And on the other hand, I have my girlfriend.
Mm.
And it's also the only part of the day that I get to speak to her. So for this first part of the day, I try to be like way more on it. Second part of the day, I try to just focus on meetings and like not use it.
Do you think you're addicted to your phone? Do you think you spend too much time scrolling social media?
No.
LinkedIn.
I have an
Twitter.
App.
Like
if I open, so I don't have Twitter. If I open Instagram, it pauses my app and it says, take a deep breath.
Do you think it's enough?
Yeah, it helps.
To hold you from...
Well, I'm also like, I want to do it, right? Like I have intent behind it. So I remind myself why I installed that app and I'm not a kid. So I'm an adult. So I think I can, you know, like I'm mature enough to put the phone down and not watch Instagram or say like, I watched it today, like for 30 minutes, it's enough. Right. And that's the thing that people sometimes want to get around and have like hacks for that. I don't think there's hacks sometimes for like mental toughness and just being a grown up. Like again, in entrepreneurship and everything.
I can see your dad speaking there like,
yeah, bro,
this is how it works. This is how life works. I love it. I love
it. It served me in entrepreneurship because it's like, yeah, I wish decisions would wait for me, that would wait that I'm ready, right, to make them. Fuck no. Like you have to make them now and you have to make them well. And so if I'm sleepy that day, tough luck. If I'm not feeling that good, tough luck. You know, what I do is I do the best of it. That's why I take my ice baths. That's why I meditate. That's why I go to the gym the best. I need to be mentally good because I need to make sure that I'm giving my best self. And it may not be 100% every day. Some days it's like 70. I'll admit to that. But I'm okay with it because I know that it's the best that I can do that day.
Why do you need to do all these things? Why do you need to, why do you feel you need to be making your best every day?
Because I'm trying to play at the highest level.
Hmm.
And if you want to play in the majors, you need to do major league training. You can't have it all.
So it's a lifestyle.
I don't see it as a lifestyle.
Is it? No, but what I'm saying is like, is it something that a common pattern that you see among people who are really successful? They look what they're eating. I mean, more and more, the new generation, they're really careful what goes into their body, what goes into what kind of content they consume, what goes into their mind, who they hang out with, all these things. Like, do I have enough sleep? Do I drink alcohol? Yeah. All these things. I feel like it's more and more the case.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that the NPCs, like, you know?
Yeah.
Talking about gaming, like NPCs, to non-player characters, they don't want to recognize. They say, oh yeah, this guy got lucky, or yeah, he's working hard, whatever. They don't see that it actually takes an entire completely different mindset and lifestyle, which we love. I love meditating also. I love to go to gym. Like I feel 10 times better, but like this thing is literally going to set me up to like do much better in life.
Yeah.
And if I'm saying, guys, I'm not drinking any day of the week, or I'm drinking once a month only, or sorry, tonight I just drink chamomile tea with honey on the side when you're all drinking alcohol. Like, it's not because I'm boring. It's because, hey, man, I have one podcast on Monday, yesterday, 7 podcasts on Tuesday, today. Like, and I want this podcast to be next level quality because the entire future, the relationship I build during this podcast, it's going to be online for forever.
Yeah.
And the intros I'll get from that and everything. I just want to do my best. So it's definitely a lifestyle.
I feel exactly the same thing.
Where do you think this entrepreneurial mindset comes from?
Mine?
Yeah.
Both my parents.
They're entrepreneurs?
No. They're just very strict.
So how does having a strict childhood impact or influence becoming an entrepreneur?
Because they always expected and wanted me to be the best.
What's your definition of being the best? Because you could continue. Like, because I have so many.
Yeah. Their definition was one, and I didn't agree with it.
What was it?
they wanted me to go to college, to have a nice job.
The classic one.
Yeah, I had the classic one, which is super fair there from another generation. Absolutely. I didn't. I dropped out of college. And I went and did my own business.
Why did you drop out of college?
I didn't feel that it was translating into skills that I was going to use. And it wasn't what I wanted to do. I would have rather worked for someone for free for like 5 years. I think that would have been, for my case, I'm not saying people should quit college. Like if you're going to be a doctor, you should. Like,
yeah.
I do think there's also careers that aren't that good in college. Like marketing, for example. If you want to do marketing, you should learn it doing marketing, not in college. So that was the path that they set. I didn't like it. I didn't do it. It was the best decision. And success has been evolving from being financially well to like when I was 18 and 20, that was like the main thing in my mind. Now I just want to be more happy, a little bit more happy every day.
How do you deal with this? Because happiness, for me, what I realize is happiness is obviously you want to have a drive, especially as an entrepreneur, you need to have a drive and a passion and feel that you're working and struggling. Actually, happiness is in the struggle, not in the results.
Yeah.
Because once you reach your milestone, like feels kind of empty, because it's like, if you don't set the next one, you're not really going to be happy. But what I realize also by doing really well and fucking up a lot and like massive fuck ups, like, for example, last year in crypto, lost like millions of dollars in 2 days. And I realized happiness is, you know, this coffee tastes good. Yeah. I meet a cool guy. I go to a nice place and I'm present. The simple things that you don't need to build companies and make a lot of money for.
Mm. Yeah, for sure.
So how is this related to trying to become the best and making money and being successful?
Yeah.
Versus like, for me, it feels like almost two separate things. Obviously, one can fuel the happiness, the feeling that you're working towards a greater goal and like a passion can fuel, but I think it's still linked, true happiness still linked to like the very small things.
Yeah. So it all depends on what happiness is for you.
What is it for you?
It's having inner peace. It's having a life where I have inner peace and my inner peace doesn't depend on external conditions. That's very hard.
Do you think that's even possible?
I wish.
Because, I mean, so it means there is always shit going to happen, but it's not going to impact you that much anymore, right?
Yeah.
And because you are trained mostly through meditation.
No.
And also, so what? Through life experiences?
So I see life as a school. And I think that as you learn your lessons, you don't need to repeat them and they don't need to affect you. I'll give you an example. Years ago, I would get like insanely, insanely frustrated when something didn't go my way, especially in business, because I was repeating the patterns of my parents of you need to be the best and that's it. Mm. And you can't be mediocre. You can't be a failure. And so I was repeating that and I was being very hard on myself because that's the way I was taught, right? Today, I still do that in some areas, like I'm far from perfect, but I see it as a school and I see it like, okay, what can I learn from this? You know? And so when something doesn't go my way, I try, like I said, in business, go back to the data, don't check my feelings, check the data, check what the market is saying, make a decision based on that. And then like in my relationship and with my girl, we're starting to become like super good at this. Like when there's an issue, we don't start to see like, oh, you did this to me or you hurt me.
After how much time in the relationship?
A year.
How much training?
And a lot. And a lot of training. And
yeah.
A lot of, yeah, ups and downs. Yeah, a lot. It wasn't easy. And she didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to do it. We've been learning to do it very recently. And we're just starting to become good at it, I'd say.
Do you use external help?
Not
like
each of us, yeah.
Podcasts. Psychologists or whatever, therapy. Yeah
I have a life coach.
Okay.
And I have things I invest in myself, like to improve. She has also like a therapist, and yeah, like we both do it separately, but we both work a lot on each other. And the conversation with her whenever we have a conflict goes from, oh, you did this to me, or I feel insecure and need to fill my insecurities, to hey, this is my insecurity, but I am feeling it. And I want to tell you about it and see how we can together resolve it as a couple and as a team. And that has changed the whole thing.
I think to end this podcast, I read yesterday, and he was really telling, a previous guest on the podcast was, he's called Loic Lemer. He built Le Web. He was early investor in LinkedIn and Twitter. He knows Jack Dorsey and all these guys from the Silicon Valley. And he now is into spirituality, goes 4 months per year in Amazon forest to live with tribes and do all this kind of stuff. And he posted this thing where it was written something like, if someone is able to make you angry, it means they have control over you. So it's exactly that. It's basically whatever someone does or triggers you with, obviously much easier to, in theory than in practice. But like, if you can become a master of yourself and not get affected, then your life is going to be much easier.
So understanding that there's no outside. At the end of the day, it's you and your mind
and your perception and your program.
Yeah,
how you receive things.
Somebody can be insulting you right now, but if you have enough self-love and you know that that's not true, you don't need to react to that. And I know that it's way harder. Like, I react to it still, you know, like I'm still not there, but I'm trying, and every single day I try a little bit more.
Amazing. Thank you so much for this.
That was awesome.
Muchas gracias.